The historical convergence of European imperialism and technological innovation in communication and travel made multiple social sites of intersection between the local and the global possible. Niall Green examines how these terrains of exchange transformed Islam during the modern period from roughly 1800 to 1940 in his new book, Terrains of Exchange, Religious Economies of Global Islam. Green sees religion as a tool for social power and explores various religious economies to determine how interpretations of Islam are negotiated and deployed. What he shows is that modern iterations of the tradition are often shaped not only by Muslims, but also Christians and Hindus. In these sites of exchange, religious actors and institutions can be analyzed as entrepreneurs and firms, which effectively compete for their clientele. Religious entrepreneurial competition and innovation fostered by Muslim-Christian interactions in imperial contexts contributed to Muslims' adaptation of Christian missionary methods for their own proselytization purposes. Overall, Green presents a world history of Islam that disrupts assertions of the unifying power of globalization on Muslims and illustrates the generative process within these terrains of exchange. In our conversation, we discussed evangelical Orientalism at England's universities, Bibles and printing in Muslim societies, language exchange, religious entrepreneurs in Hyderabad, traditions of Hindu Sufism, and the construction of the first mosques in Detroit and Japan. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Niall Green. Welcome, Niall. Thanks for joining me on New Books in Islamic Studies. How are you?
Yeah, I'm pretty good. Thank you, Christian.
So this book, Terrains of Exchange, Religious Economies of Global Islam, is really a wonderful read. And I think a book that perhaps you and a few other people could only produce. It's theoretically rich and brings in really kind of detailed but very accessible and interesting case studies to think about some of these theories and methods you're putting into play. So I appreciate the book and I look forward to hearing about it. But we always start with a little bit about our authors. So if you could take a moment to just tell us a little bit about how you got interested in Islamic studies, perhaps individuals or moments that have been influential in shaping the types of questions you ask or the locations that you're interested in, or how did you get to where you are today?
Yeah, well, really, in many ways, it all started as a sort of tale I've told many times before, won't tell at length now, but at the age of 17, I got a train from where I grew up in England to Istanbul, which is as far as I could get, and I spent the summer knocking around Turkey, and then in the next few years, when I left high school when I was 18, and then when I was 19 and 20, I was traveling alone, as usual, around eastern Turkey, wandering across the border into Iran one time, in fact, when I was 18, and then in Egypt, and by the time I was 20, I was in North India. And throughout my 20s, really, I kind of only really did my studies because it was a way of legitimizing my fascination with life on the road in the Middle East and the Islamic world more generally. And as time went on, I spent a lot of time in Iran, and I did my master's at Cambridge. I did my MPhil in Oriental Studies, it was called then, and focusing particularly on Persian. And I spent quite a bit of time in Iran. And then I kind of started going to places like Pakistan, spent a fair bit of time there. And then over the years, I actually took a bunch of years out, the gap years in my CV, leading so-called adventure tours through places like, places very inaccessible now, in fact, places like Syria and Yemen. I later traveled in Afghanistan and Central Asia and other places too. And those travels really, I think, very much kind of shaped my primary encounter with the Islamic world, not through books, but primarily and originally through what I would now call really kind of terrains, through really, you know, being sur le terrain, as the French would say, being on the ground. And throughout my 20s, when I kind of pondered grad school and moved into it, I thought I might become an anthropologist. And in many ways, anthropology and that side of the social sciences were much more the kind of forms of methodology that really had much more rapport with me. But I was fundamentally interested in the past. So when I lived in India for my PhD in my late 20s, I did my PhD at SOAS in London. When I lived in India, I was really kind of very interested in trying to trace, as it were, the imprint of the past through institutions, particularly at that time Sufi shrines, that and to try to understand the past through the tradition and the forms of tradition that it was handed down by, five forms of local memory, spoken, oral history, but also, of course, through hagiographies and local histories written in situ. So really that experience, really, which is ongoing, I think this is the first year, this year, of the last 26 years that I haven't been traveling somewhere in the Islamic world, but that kind of quarter century, really, of being, you know, on the road for between 1 and 7 months, or even 8-9 months a year, in my 20s, certainly, really shaped my approach as a historian. And that really, I think, for me at least, is the ways of really trying to work out, in many ways, that dissonance between the experience of Islam in situ, in its various and very varied terrains, as I would call it, and what I started to read about through my undergraduate and graduate studies of the representations of Islam in scholarship, and indeed self-representations by Muslims, and not least in the modern period of let's say, kind of reformist and reformation-based Islam. That kind of dissonance, I think, has really driven my intellect over the decades to try to come up with the formulations, at least to my own somewhat satisfaction, and in terrains of exchange, of trying to form a way of understanding, on the one hand, kind of what are clearly a broader problem in Islamic history of trying to understand broader trans-regional, transnational forms of continuity, the Arabic script being the most obvious one that's always pointed to. But of course, the other great variable, and particularly from scholars such as you or me, who's primary point of reference, or at least starting point, has been not in the Middle East, whether in China or South Asia, to understand that interaction between, let's say, kind of the local and the trans-regional and the global. And of course, as I moved on to being a modernist over a series of books, that's what I've really tried to deal with this book, Terrains of Exchange.
Yeah, that's interesting. You can really see that in this book, at least, and in much of your other work too, how that experience must have shaped your approach. Can you talk a little bit about how this particular book began to emerge as a book, and how it relates to some of your other scholarship?
The book began, in at least its core parts, really, with a series of individual case studies of places where I was then living, I guess, in my 20s, and working on more intensely in what's now what was Hyderabad state in the sort of princely state of the Muslim royal princely state in the middle of India. And then I started doing much more work on something that always interested me, which was the beginnings of Islamic printing and the impact of printing on Muslims and indeed on Islam more generally. It was over a period of years, really, that I started to see patterns emerging from these case studies. And then I was driven to try to understand what was the bigger overarching set of processes and patterns that I could extrapolate from these, what were originally in many ways quite local, at least a few of the chapters emerged as local case studies. And then it was a question really of then new kind of newer interests and newer places of interest that I developed, particularly in the spread of Islam or the Muslim outreach to Japan and the United States in the 20th century, and to try to understand how I could position those effectively. The US and Japan really interested me as places where a few, an unquantifiable number of African slaves in the, let's say, antebellum US, and perhaps an unknown number, quite possibly zero number of Hui Chinese merchants in Tokugawa or pre-Tokugawa Japan. Effectively, the US and Japan were places where there was no Muslim community, no Muslim outreach in the early modern period. So these struck me as being wonderful case studies of new areas, new terrains, where Muslims had a very kind of rapid outreach, really, in the first couple of decades of the 20th century. So to try to tie on these kind of newer areas of Islamic expansion to much kind of older and more familiar ones, the Middle East, Persia in particular, and South Asia, some of the other chapters in the book, struck me as an intellectual challenge, but really an important one to test any methodology in global studies and global history. Because, of course, if a process is going to be genuinely global, it has to work in very varied and different terrains, as I'm going to insist on calling it. We might define that term a bit later.
Yeah. Maybe we can start there, because I think this is one of the real valuable pieces here that can be extended to other folks working in Islamic studies, is this idea of terrains of exchange, this intersection of local and global. So What do you mean exactly by this phrase? What ways can a site of exchange be understood as a generative process, which you call it, and what kind of outcomes are possible in these sites?
Well, what I'm trying to do with this idea of a terrain of exchange is really develop a methodology, I think, for global history, which I think has often had its primary origins in, let's say, the hard side of the social sciences, economics, and so on, and indeed migration studies, etc., has been in many ways, even for historians with world systems theory, etc., a kind of a top-down driven field in many ways. I'm trying to approach global history and the study of globalizing processes from bottom up, and to start then, and to show a methodology, you'd be able to start from a range of different terrains, different terroirs, as it were, different sites of local richness and local culture, and to be able to do that in, unlike much of global history, which I still think has as its starting point the West and the Western world. So I'm trying to start using the idea of terrains then as a place of bottom-up globalization. And when I talk about globalization, I mean two things. I mean, on the one hand, I mean what we might more familiarly think of globalization, which is movement, travel, migration, intersections in kind of new places in the book, places like Japan and America. But with regard to terrains then, I'm also very interested in the study of globalization in situ. That's to say, a place might be extremely distant. Much of my work, not in this book, is focused on, let's say, kind of globalizing processes within modern Afghanistan, a place that seems to be very remote, but a place in which throughout the 20th century, and in various ways before, but particularly throughout the 20th century, the world has encroached upon those, particular landlocked corners of Afghanistan. In terrains of exchange, the case studies I look at are, let's say, landlocked parts of India, Hyderabad state, unlike the more classic ports model of globalization, looking at, whether it's Calcutta or myself, Bombay, etc. And also the perhaps much more remote, apparently remote, areas of central Eurasia in the Caucasus Mountains, the borders of the Russian Empire and Persia in the early mid-decades of the 19th century. So I'm trying to use terrains then as a way of understanding not only, as it were, people coming out of particular places to the wider world, but the wider world coming to these particular places that may seem quite remote, but are nonetheless subject in the modern period at least to forces of globalization. And of course, globalization really is often seen as a pattern of exchange. And what I'm interested in really is, and we'll perhaps come on to this in a few minutes, the using the methodology of religious economy to look at processes of exchange that happen that are dynamic, that are, as you mentioned, the key word often used is the idea of generative exchange, that when these interactions, the kind of classic motif, if you like, of globalization and global history, when interactions take place, that they generate something new, that this is, as it were, a kind of a productive dialectic between the meetings and what I look at, between the meetings of European and Indian American Christians and a whole range of whether Indian, Tatar, Persian, or various other Muslims throughout these different sites of case studies that I look at in the book.
Yeah, and I think this is especially in kind of historical studies, this idea of religious economies is very helpful. Of course, this has been going on in the sociology of religion for a long time. But what do you mean, or what does it mean to think about religious actors and institutions as entrepreneurs and firms? And what insights do we gain from examining Islam in the context of religious economies?
Okay, well, the main thing that drew me originally to the model of religious economy, which is something I use first of all in my book Bombay Islam, and I see terrains of exchange as a follow-up to Bombay Islam that uses the same methodology of religious economy in a whole different set of environments, a different set of terrains, a different sequence of local marketplaces to show how the model of religious economy can show very divergent outcomes. And I think that's the strength of any theoretical model, that it can cope with and indeed deal with a kind of a whole variety of different variables and different outcomes. The thing that attracted me really initially to religious economy some years ago was a real dissatisfaction with the lack of an analytical vocabulary within the study of Islam, and indeed within the historical study of Islam. I think very much that historians of Islam and indeed scholars of Islam more generally have adapted or taken on, I think in many cases uncritically, the emic, the internal vocabulary of Muslims themselves, and particularly Muslim reformists. What I've tried to do with adopting the model of religious economy, I'm not claiming to invent it. We can talk about perhaps some of its inventors earlier, not least Rodney Stark, the American sociologist. But by adapting the model and the language of religious economy, I've tried to create really in many ways what I've called a kind of an anti-rhetoric that gives us a new level, I think, of theoretical distance from our subject of study. Rather than adopting then, as it were, the familiar language of tradition, I think religious economy is really useful because as historians, it helps us to factor in change and crucially innovation. Now, the language of tradition, of course, which is whether explicitly or implicitly, really still, I think, informs much of the way we study religion, would claim that, as it were, there are some founding figures and some key persons and key moments, classical periods, formative periods, etc., prophets, key texts, etc. And then, as it were, there's the process of traditio, of handing down, in some way unchanged, perhaps moved or reinterpreted. But fundamentally, I think the language and the model of tradition, of traditio, that which was handed down, I think really informs the way Islam is studied inside and outside of the academy. And I think that's really problematic for historians because it doesn't allow us to factor in what I see as the constant regeneration and the constant reinvention and the constant to greater and lesser degree in different times and places innovation within any religious community and set of communities. And again, with regard to Islam, of course, the issue of innovation becomes particularly tricky when we're talking about emic and etic terms, because for Muslims themselves, innovation, bid'ah, of course, is by and large a bad thing. So Muslims themselves historically, and indeed, you know, people writing within the tradition or, as I've said, scholars influenced by it, will by and large downplay innovation because this is seen as being, as it were, something that is not authentically Islamic. And yet, of course, if we're working as historians, what we fundamentally have to deal with, as it were, the bottom line of historical study is the study of change. So what is religious economy? I think the most important added value, so to speak, of a model of religious economy is not only that it helps us move away from tradition and things being, as it were, passively handed down to reckon with the agency of religious innovation and thereby change. The other, I think, radical difference with religious economy as a model of analysis is that it factors in not only the supply side of religion, but also the demand side. Now, what do I mean by that? Conventionally, when we study religion, of course, you know, even as historians and indeed even as social historians, we study without necessarily realizing it. We study what a religious economist would classify as the supply side of religion. That's to say, we study the prophets, the founders, the texts, the leaders, the imams, the sheikhs, all of the key figures, as it were, that seem to be doing religion and whether creating or handing down religion, the supply side of religion, rather than, as it were, all of what one might call the followers, or in religious economy terms, all of the people who constitute the demand side of religion. And what religious economy, I think, really adds importantly to a historical analysis is that religious economy claims that the contours, the shape, the character of religion in any given social environment, what it would conceive as a marketplace, perhaps more of that in a moment, the character, the profile of religion and religious activity in any given terrain, any given marketplace, is the outcome of interaction between suppliers and demanders. Now, that can make really, I think, a radical difference. I mean, within my book on Bombay Islam, I think the big difference it showed there was that according to, as it were, kind of standard Weberian sociology, which has been so hugely influential on the study of Islam, has really, as it were, boosted the historical role of reformist Islam, a modern, as it were, industrialized, relatively educated environment such as Bombay in the 19th, early 20th century should, according to Weberian theory, we would expect to see a whole range of, let's say, kind of reformist, disenchanted Islams emerging and flourishing there. And indeed, from the supply side, that is indeed what happened. But when, in my study in Bombay, I factored in the demand side, which is where the cultural taste and preferences of all of the consumers in a religious marketplace, all of the people who wanted and needed and looked for religion in colonial Bombay, their tastes and preferences were actually not for a disenchanted textualist literary Islam, but they were for an Islam that could actually help them with the needs in their lives, with the demands they had for miracles, for intercession, for healing, for even for relaxing and carnivals, no less, a carnivalesque musical Islam. So again, the importance of demand side, it brings a dynamic into the whole process of what religion is, rather than simply the suppliers. Religious economy brings in this picture then of a complex and constantly generative dynamic that is in tension between the resources available to a set of religious suppliers and their tastes and preferences, what they want to show is, as it were, the true religion, and their own actual decisions being based upon, as it were, a kind of bargain with the demanders in the marketplace, with the people that they're trying to attract to them as a demand base, with the people they're trying to attract to them as their followers. And of course, what that means then, of course, and the other crucial element of religious economy is that it factors in processes of competition. And competition, as distinct, analytically distinct, I think, from conflict, competition, I think, is again a crucial ingredient, a crucial motor in tracing religious innovation and change, because it's competition between different religious suppliers that actually creates the impetus for religious suppliers to change, adapt, differentiate their religious products, their services in any given marketplace, depending upon the number of people, the number of potential competitors there are in that marketplace. So a marketplace then might be, as it were, a village at the most simple level, where there is only one leading, let's say, saintly family that is there for generations, and there is no other religious supplier. That's going to be a pretty static marketplace in which there is minimal competition, and there is, relatively speaking, minimal impetus for religious innovation and change. When we move to more complex urban environments, or indeed complex globalized environments, such as where the Caucasus Mountains in Hyderabad State that I study in the book, when we come to a period of more interaction, of more global exchange, then there will be an increasing number of suppliers competing within any given marketplace, any given terrain. And again, within context of globalization, not all of those competitors, those alternative religious suppliers, will be of the same religion. Not all of them will be Muslim. And what I look at the book then, fundamentally as a historian starting to move towards the details and the context and the particular case studies rather than just the theory, is the impact then over the very long 19th century, as it were, the period of imperial globalization, I call it, from around 1800 to 1940, the impact then of Christian evangelical missionary firms, as I call them, and their impact as catalysts in provoking Muslim religious suppliers, Muslim religious entrepreneurs and innovators to adopt and adapt Christian missionary techniques for their own purposes. So the process of competition then that I look at in the book, and of course can be used for religious economy in many different contexts, can be between different followers of apparently the same faith themselves, but constantly driven by competition to differentiate their particular and distinct Islams in the plural, or it can be between suppliers of, as it were, quite different religions. And of course that very much in some ways, I think, a characteristic of the modern period, the drive towards conversion and notions of free choice and individual choice in terms of choosing one's own religion.
Yeah, I think it's a really useful model, and I hope others will follow the way you're paving here, because I think it could be effective in the vast majority of case studies if we start to think about Muslims across the globe. Now, this there's three sections to the book where you're looking at kind of different sites, similar sites in many ways. And the first section, you look at this kind of entrepreneurial competition and innovation fostered by Muslim-Christian interactions in imperial contexts largely. And the first one you look at is what you call evangelical Orientalism as it's occurring at England's universities. So could you talk a little bit about what this stream of Orientalism that you're laying out here is all about, and how did it shape Muslim religious entrepreneurs?
Yes, well, I start the book. I mean, the point really of starting with the Christian evangelicals is really just starting at, as it were, one point of ongoing cycles of exchange. And as I point out, in many ways, the Christian evangelical movements were themselves reactions and, as it were, kind of new, as it were, Christian innovations in terms of organization, indeed, in some ways of doctrine as well, reactions to the impetus of the discovery of, and then, of course, the making of an empire first in the Americas, and then the second British Empire, of course, in Asia. But the what I see as what I've called evangelical Orientalism is really the very important phase of when Oriental knowledge and Oriental learning was first put to the service of empire, and indeed first engaged with the empire, and particularly the Second British Empire in India. And this was a period when Orientalism, in fact, wasn't, as Edward Said has kind of explicitly stated, a secular enterprise. Quite the opposite. It was a deeply Christian enterprise. And the great endowed professors in Arabic, the two endowed chairs in Arabic at Oxford and at Cambridge, indeed many of their other, you know, kind of assistants and minions, were deeply involved with the Church and Mission Society, the British and Foreign Bible Society, and various other of the number of evangelical organizations that were founded very rapidly between around 1790 and 1810. And what's important about the impact of these missionaries is their huge investment in translation of the Bible into Islamic languages, including a whole range of Islamic vernaculars, some of which had actually had no written form even in their own local environments, and a range of Turkic languages, not least. And no less importantly, combined with that translation, that vernacularization of scripture, and indeed the vernacularization of writing and learning, the other important aspect of the evangelical Orientalists was the huge investment in printing in Islamic languages. And we have to bear in mind, of course, with the exception of the outlier Ibrahim Mutafarika and son in the Ottoman Empire, effectively Muslims don't begin printing anywhere till around 1820. And that's one of the chapter that, in a way, that actually does follow the first chapter on the evangelical Orientals and their outreach to the Muslim world, is what happens then, the reaction, the response, the adaptive and innovative response of various individual Muslim religious entrepreneurs that I look at, that manage to adopt and adapt the Christian missionary technique, our printing, and indeed vernacular printing, for their own purposes. So what we're seeing here then in the book is that first and very, very crucial generative form of interaction, that productive dialectic by which Muslims adopt printing, a hugely, obviously, hugely world historically important process, and start to adapt that, obviously, for a range of what will, in, you know, kind of in some cases become, of course, artistic and scientific ends. But for my purposes, adopting printing for religious ends, and particularly for Muslim evangelical ends. So communication technologies, translation as a technology and translation skills, printing as a technology and printing skills, and also the use of new forms of travel as travel communication, the railroad and, of course, the steamship, about which I've written a great deal in many of my other books. This is one of the crucial forms of adaptation that these new Muslim entrepreneurs take from the Christian missionary competition. And they're very often much more successful because, of course, they have the Muslim religious entrepreneurs have a greater sense of the local tastes and preferences, the local demand base of their particular environments, their particular terrains. The other very crucial element that the new Muslim religious entrepreneurs adapt from the Christian missionaries is the organizational form of the mission itself. And this is really a long-standing and ongoing process. When we look across the 20th century, really, at the range of new Muslim organizations that are founded, it's really striking how many of them have such terms as tabligh, dawah, irshad, or indeed even mission, taken, you know, as a loan word from the English word mission, in their titles. The Tablighi Jamaat, of course, being probably the most influential worldwide at the moment today. And what we're seeing here is effectively, as I say, the adaptation and the kind of the usage of of Christian missionary organizational techniques of forming effectively voluntary societies founded by based upon subscription rather than based upon the largesse of aristocrats and sultans and padshahs, emperors and whatnot in the kind of the early modern period. The adaptation of these techniques, and indeed in many ways, again, this is the importance of an etic vocabulary, the covering up of that adaptation process by giving them what seemed to be very old and esteemed, emic internal Muslim terms, such as dawah, a term which seems to have been around since the Fatimids and presumably the Quran beforehand. So, this is in the book, this is the first sequence that I look at, really, this initial process then of from around 1800 to 1850, the beginnings of this process of generative exchange, which will be followed up by, roughly speaking, the second half of the 19th century, when we start to get an increasing number of Muslim religious entrepreneurs adopting these techniques and particularly the organizational techniques of the mission, but doing so in relatively localized context within, as it were, home ground. So the case studies I look at there are, in fact, largely within Hyderabad state in India, and actually showing that one of the claims I make is that agency is more important than identity in religious economy, which is to say one doesn't necessarily need to be a Muslim to make, as it were, innovative changes in the religious life of Muslims. The Christian missionaries, of course, are one example of that. But the case study I look at, or one of the case studies I look at with regard to Hyderabad, is the way in which an important Hindu Kayasta, an important member of the old kind of Persianate secretarial class within Hyderabad state, and a prominent member of the Hyderabadi bureaucracy, but nonetheless a Hindu, manages to innovate and create, as it were, a new kind of Vedantic Sufism. And indeed, I also look at other cases within Hyderabad when we have kind of new forms of kind of Sufi yoga, and indeed of kind of Sufism blended with Freemasonry and Theosophy. So again, the point is that agency is more important than necessarily identity. So within those sections of the book, then I'm really looking at, as it were, a period, second half of the 19th century, more or less, when new Muslim religious firms are managing to have a considerable impact within what were, you know, kind of traditionally Muslim domains, albeit domains where there are obviously kind of Hindus and others as well in some places. The third period I look at the book then is the part of the book, part three, that I call innovators, or rather exporters. And that's when we see from approximately around the beginnings of the 20th century, we start to see the networks of the British Empire, but indeed wider networks of globalization and of kind of globalized steam travel in particular, that now connect Muslims with places as far, as distant, and as completely new as the United States and Japan. And we see Muslim religious entrepreneurs, Muslim missionaries no less, adopting the older techniques of Christian missionaries to start to export Islam to what were, as it were, traditionally Christian-dominated religious marketplaces, or indeed Shinto-Buddhist-dominated religious marketplaces within Japan.
Yeah, and this third section really is fascinating in terms of how Muslim outreach is expanding beyond these kind of more traditional boundaries. One place you look at is the construction of the first mosque in Detroit in 1921. Can you tell us a little bit about what was behind this project, what strategies were used to build this community, and what responses did the project elicit from Muslims in America?
Yeah, I found that the Detroit Mosque a really fascinating project. I mean, the Detroit Mosque, there are various claimants to being the first mosque in the United States, but I think the Detroit Mosque was the first purpose-built mosque in the United States, even though it's not now the oldest one because it actually kind of was destroyed around 1930. But it's the first purpose-built mosque in the United States, and that struck me as being extremely important because one of the themes, one of the theoretical agendas I have in the book as well is borrowing not only from the sociology of Rodney Stark and other founders of religious economy, but also from the sociology of Michael Mann and his work on the sources of social power. And I'm very interested in trying to trace religion as a really important, and I think for globalization theorists, and I think for many sociologists formed, as it were, in the background of of modernization theory across the 20th century and the expectation of increasing secularization. I think religion has often been kind of under-theorized within both kind of as a force of globalization and indeed as a source of social power. Now, Michael Mann makes a very important point. That when he's talking about social power, he, or at least my reading of him, the idea is that, you know, social power is, as it were, the basic energy of the human world. That's to say, it's the power to shape opinions, mindscapes, behaviors, affections, the affiliations of groups, the contours of community. Social power is, in short, it's a means of defining and directing collective human endeavors. And of course, that's what religion does, or at least that's what religious leaders are able to do. They're able to harness, as it were, group powers and, as it were, shape group decision making through, you know, their, what we would basically call their doctrines. Now, a point that Mann makes with regard to how social power, this kind of social power, power over others in the social world, is made, is the importance of institutions. It's a very key and elementary point, of course. But I think in the study of religion and religion in the social world, one of the things that I've always been interested in, let's say my, you know, my book Sufism and Global History, is tracing the basic institutions of Sufism. And it's through those institutions that individual Sufis were able to, as it were, shape history and ultimately a kind of a worldwide scale. In the case here of the United States and Japan, the particular institutions I'm interested in here are mosques. And I think it's very interesting also, really, with regard to the modern period I'm looking at in this book, the period, let's say, from 1800 through 1914. Indeed, I think the same processes can entirely be seen continuing in the more recent period of globalization after the Cold War in the last 25 years or so. We're dealing with a period of globalization in which, by and large, the institutionalization of Islam is carried out through voluntary organizations of the kinds I've said were modeled on adaptations of the Christian mission and on mosques. And this is quite distinct from the early modern period of Muslim globalization, which, of course, doesn't reach Japan and the United States, when outreach is largely through Sufi brotherhoods and through Sufi shrines, albeit in many cases, but not all, with mosques attached in, you know, in some ways, a subsidiary relationship. So these mosques are really important case studies for me, the first mosque in the United States and Japan, because they are symptomatic of a distinctive period in Islamic history when the mosque becomes the defining institution of expansion, the production of social power in new terrains and indeed in old terrains as well, overtaking the shrine and overtaking the Sufi brotherhoods associated with the shrine, with Sufi shrines. And also as a means of actually kind of looking at, as I say, through via Mann, the institutionalization and therefore the increase of social power available to people who control mosques. And again, of course, that's kind of a very key, I think, kind of takeaway lesson for modern day as well. So getting back to the nitty gritty of the details of the Detroit Mosque, what's very interesting there is the Detroit Mosque emerges, of course, in a period of industrial globalization. It's built right opposite Henry Ford's factory with the world's first production line, the Highland Park factory. The Highland Park factory, of course, and indeed Detroit's industrialization more generally, has attracted a huge number of migrants to Detroit, not least the great migration of African Americans from the South, but also, lesser known by and large, a large number of Ottoman immigrants, whether Lebanese Christians, but also a considerable number of Lebanese and other Ottoman Muslims, including Albanians, to Detroit. And it's an Albanian, sorry, a Lebanese migrant and actually kind of a commercial entrepreneur, a real estate developer, as he becomes, called Mohammed Karoub, who founds and establishes the mosque. And yet there is no imam to run the mosque. Now, who arrives in the United States at that period? By at this point, actually, happy coincidence, a member of the Ahmadiyya religious firm, as I would call them, the Ahmadiyya Anjuman, one of the greatest and perhaps the most important of all innovative and globalizing Muslim religious firms of the 19th, early 20th century. This Ahmadiyya religious missionary, Muslim missionary, turns up in, first of all, in Pennsylvania by steamship, and then makes his way to Detroit. And he manages to persuade Mohammed Karoub to allow him to take over the mosque and be the imam. From that base of the mosque, he sets up a periodical in English again, using, as it were, language skills, translation skills, language skills that he'd already learned in India, and particularly in the Punjab where he comes from. I think there really is the Punjab in Indian religious history in the colonial period is really, as it were, the burned over district, to borrow a term from American religious historiography, the burned over district of India, where there's been such intense religious activity, such intense innovation, such intense exchange with Christian missionaries since the early 1800s, since around the 1820s. So Mufti Muhammad Sadiq, the missionary who comes to Detroit, sets up a newspaper, starts using the very vibrant U.S. public sphere to issue what he calls in his Urdu autobiography, he uses the word frequently, challenge Karana. So we get a sense of semantic exchange going on here over in the language, using the English word challenge, of course, with the Urdu verb from Karana, to make a challenge. And he makes challenges in various church halls, various workers' halls, various other public places, as well as in print, of people to, as it were, disprove Islam. So he's adapting the missionaries of the Christians, the Christian missionaries in India, and turning them on their head, rather than Christian missionaries offering challenges to Muslim scholars to disprove the truth of Christianity, or indeed the Christians themselves disproving the truth claims of Islam. Here we have exactly that turned on its head by this figure, Mufti Muhammad Sadiq, who's doing that entirely within the United States. He's reaching out very intelligently. He's actually a wonderful example of a religious entrepreneur, because he develops a pretty good, for an immigrant, a recent immigrant who turns up in 1921, he develops a pretty rapid and canny sense of demand within that new Detroit religious marketplace, full of, in particular, African-American migrants from the South. And he reaches out in particular through his English language magazine and through his preaching in and around Detroit and also in Chicago. He reaches out to African-Americans, telling them that your true religion is Islam, that Christianity is the religion of your enslavers. And of course, this becomes a very important theme in the subsequent history of African-American Islam. He manages to convert, according to the names are given in Muslim Sunrise, something like upwards of 1,000 Americans, including a very significant proportion of African-Americans. But what's particularly interesting to me by looking at the marketplace in Detroit and following the after story of Mufti Muhammad Sadiq is showing how the beginnings of African-American Islam comes not only from Mufti Muhammad Sadiq's own entry to the marketplace, but then the emergence of African-American religious entrepreneurs, such as the noble Drew Ali, who are active in Detroit and Chicago at exactly the same time as Mufti Muhammad Sadiq, but of course have a greater sense of the demand of fellow and the cultural tastes and preferences, the religious needs of fellow African-Americans. And of course, it's in adaptation of Mufti Muhammad Sadiq's own message that these various African-American entrepreneurs, who, of course, are much more familiar in the history of religion in America in the 20th century, that they, as it were, adapt Mufti Muhammad's techniques that he's adapted from Christian missionaries to much more successfully then reach out to fellow African-Americans. And, of course, then we get the creation of new Muslim religious firms in America that are led by and devoted to a demand base of African-Americans. And this, again, is important to shift back to the theoretical dimensions of the book, because the larger claim I'm making in the book really is to argue against one particular line within studies of globalization and the process of globalization more generally. And that's that idea that globalization leads to forms of cultural and indeed by implication religious homogenization. And of course, within the history, or indeed the historical study of Islam, whether pan-Islamism or indeed more recent forms of pan-Islamism, or if you like, of global Islam or Islam mondialisé, or as it's called by various scholars, there's been a kind of a similar notion that Islam will become indeed more standardized and more familiar through the process of globalization. What I'm showing throughout the book, through the case studies and through the theoretical model, is entirely the opposite. In fact, what religious economy shows and demonstrates is that increasing interaction, thereby increasing competition, increasing globalization, increasing interaction. Increasing interaction means increasing competition between different religious entrepreneurs, whether fellow Muslims, for example, or non-Muslims. And that dialectic, as I've said, creates a process of generative exchange, which creates new religious entrepreneurs whose drive in competing with their fellow entrepreneurs, Muslim or otherwise, is to differentiate their product and services. The outcome then, as we've seen in Detroit, is not one Islam that everyone follows, but within a few years within Detroit and Chicago, the emergence of a whole bunch of new religious Muslim religious entrepreneurs and firms. In short, then, globalization leads not to homogenization of Islam, but increasing diversification and indeed increasing fragmentation. And I think that is entirely what we're seeing when we look around the world today. Of course, all different Muslim and Muslim religious entrepreneurs are still speaking the language of Tawheed, speaking the language of unity, and speaking in terms that scholars might say this is pan-Islamism. But that's the importance of actually differentiating between the message and the claims, as it were, the emic level of analysis, and differentiating between that and the ethic level of analysis, and particularly the social underlying realities beneath these claims of unity and unifying messages. Because what we're actually seeing is, in the present, as indeed in the period I studied in the book up until 1940, is increasing numbers of religious entrepreneurs, a dizzying number of new religious firms actually claiming to be supplying the same Islam. But the social reality is increasing competition and increasing fragmentation, not increasing homogenization or unification or still less Muslim unity.
So this generative exchange is also really exemplified in this case study of the first mosque in Japan. So can you tell us about this project and the factors that made it possible?
Yes, I found the case study of the first mosque in Japan, which was founded in 1935, as late as 1935 in the port city of Kobe. I found this a wonderful case study for religious economy because, insofar as we can as historians looking at sort of modern urban environments, it represented something like kind of laboratory conditions. What do I mean by that somewhat outrageous claim for a historian? Well, of course, Tokugawa Japan's policy of closure to the outside world meant that Japan's opening to the world, as it's traditionally been called in the Meiji period, sets up a very rapid series of interactions based around really mostly a couple of port cities, Yokohama, Kobe, Nagasaki, and one or two others. And it's really these new port cities, and Kobe as one of them, that very rapidly see not just the arrival of, if you like, kind of the merchants and diplomats, the political and economic forms of global interaction, which are, you know, after all, usually the wherewithal of global history, but also the opening of Japan and Japan's ports sees the arrival of a whole new series of new religious firms and religious entrepreneurs, again, in this very short period. So we can see the rapid, as it were, liberalization of a religious marketplace. Now, what I mean by the liberalization of a religious marketplace, and this is, again, a kind of a key aspect of the study of religious economy, is that there can be many forms of religious economy, of course, and that's why religious economy can be applied to any period and place in history. There can be, as it were, village-based, very closed and non-dynamic, relatively static religious economies. There can be, as it were, command religious economies, like command commercial economies, in which the state is dominant. Look at most of the, as it were, the Islamic states in the world today. The state is a major player in defining the religious activities that at least allowed by law by its citizens. Or one can have, as it were, laissez-faire liberal religious economies when the state steps away from directing and having a direct role in defining and legalizing and illegalizing, so to speak, the religious activities of its citizens. Now, there's a general kind of, as it were, truism within religious economy, or indeed perhaps a general truth, I can go as far to say to that, that to the greater extent that the state steps away from religious transactions in its domain, in its country, there will be more freedom to interact, more freedom to innovate, and there will be, as it were, more religious activity, more religion produced, more religious change. Of course, the United States, of course, is the great example of that, which is why religious economy in many ways emerged through the study of the United States, because, of course, it's the place where historically one has had more religious innovation and more religious competition. But of course, you know, the United States is not the only liberal religious economy where the state, relatively speaking, of course, there is no perfectly liberal economy any more than religious economy any more than any kind of perfect and complete liberal commercial economy. But of course, the point is that throughout the modern period, throughout the imperial period, indeed the modern period in other places like Japan, one sees the state stepping away from religious transactions, the religious life of its citizens in various places. The British Empire, of course, is one of the key examples in that I study in this book and Bombay Islam, when the British Empire at least claims, and by and large, obviously with various exceptions, by and large steps back from directing the religious activities of the people of the empire. And of course, this has a twinfold effect, that of course it also allows in a whole series of Christian missionary organizations at the old East India Company, which had controlled the religious activities of at least Christians in its domains, had tried to prevent. So when we turn to Japan, one of the crucial moments there in Meiji Japan is the Meiji Constitution, if I remember correctly. I don't have any notes, unfortunately, 1881. And the Meiji Constitution, kind of, at least again in theory and by law, guarantees the right to religious freedom of Japanese citizens. This coincides with the arrival then in Japan of a wide range of foreign settlers, businessmen, teachers, all kinds of, as it were, job seekers, effectively, from around the four corners of the world, particularly from the Western world, United States, Canada, and various countries in Europe. This causes a number of religious entrepreneurs and religious firms to turn up in particularly Yokohama and Kobe and set up churches for the new demand base of these immigrants. So it's, as it were, the parallel to what we saw a moment ago with the first mosque in America, when it's actually Muslim immigrants to the U.S. forming a new demand base and then African-American converts. Here, the initial impetus in Japan for religious change is Christian migrants to the port cities of Japan, bringing Christian religious firms and the building of Japan's first churches for effectively for about 300 years since the early Tokugawa period, when the churches were closed and destroyed in Japan. Now, what this sets up then in turn is the drive to convert Japanese legally through the Meiji Constitution and the arrival of a whole series of Western missionaries who seek to not only, as it were, cater to the demand base of Christian immigrants, but also to convert Japanese. And this is a period in modern Japanese history when there are, you know, kind of large numbers of Japanese converts, many of them, as it were, kind of, as it were, you know, modernist in various ways as well. Not unlike in various other societies, Korea and to some extent other parts of Asia as well, China in this period. Now, it's also somewhat later in the Meiji period, indeed at the end of the Meiji period, by the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, that we get the arrival in Japan of not only European and American businessmen, but also a number of Indian and also Indian Muslim businessmen. At the same time, there are a number of not only, as it were, this demand base of Muslim merchants in Japan, but also a number of Muslim religious entrepreneurs, missionaries who come to Japan with the express aim of trying to convert the Japanese, and in particular, the idea that they can convert the Japanese emperor to Islam, and then, as it were, have a powerful Muslim empire to rival what these Muslim religious entrepreneurs see as the Christian empires of the Russians, the British, the French, and the Dutch. Over a period of time, then, what we can actually see emerging in Kobe is reflecting what I showed in that intense terrain of exchange in Detroit, is this very rapid and intense process of competition, emulation, adaptation between Christian religious entrepreneurs, missionaries, interestingly also theosophical and Baha'i religious entrepreneurs, and then the first Muslim religious entrepreneurs that also turn up in Kobe, in Yokohama, and indeed in Tokyo and other parts of Japan. The ultimate outcome of that is the building of the first mosque in Japan. But what's very interesting about the first mosque, again, is this importance of trying to create tangible institutions of social, that's to say religious power, is that the mosque itself, just like the first mosque in the United States, the first purpose-built mosque in the United States in Detroit, are actually themselves reflect the deeply hybridized nature of the new Islam, or at least the new tangible forms of Islam, that's to say the mosque, in both places. Because the builder, the architect and the builder of the first mosque in the United States was Theodore Degenhardt, if I remember his name correctly, who was actually, you know, a Detroit-based architect who was more familiar with building movie theaters there in the 1910s and 20s in Detroit. When we move to the case of Kobe, the first mosque in Japan, the designer there, the architect employed there, was, again, a very canny move on behalf of the Muslim religious entrepreneurs of adapting and adopting the techniques of the Christian innovators there. The architect for the mosque was a Czech bohemian, a former Austro-Hungarian subject called Jan Jozef Svagar, who had just 2 years earlier designed and built the Sacred Heart Catholic Cathedral in Yokohama. Then, as it were, the Muslim investors in the mosque in Kobe, as it were, poach him, employ a group of British accountants who they had previously used, British accountants and solicitors, lawyers who they previously used for their commercial transactions, and employ a Japanese contracting firm, Takanaka Corporation, that had since the Meiji period specialized in building Western, that's to say European, buildings. The outcome then, tangibly then, for both mosques, is that they look somehow Oriental and Eastern, but somehow look quite Art Nouveau and indeed kind of Art Deco by the 1920s and 30s. The mosque built in Kobe then by Jan Jozef Svagar looks kind of very similar in its architectural features to the Catholic church he designed 2 years earlier. Now, this is important overall then within, again, the larger claims of the book in trying to show that in the modern period, despite, as it were, the emic claims of Muslim entrepreneurs, firms, and indeed Muslim demanders, Muslim believers themselves, that what we're not seeing is the handing down of tradition. What we're seeing, I think, is through a social scientific analysis, is that like any other cultural product in an age of globalization, according to a leading globalization theorist, what we're seeing with Islam, as in with any other cultural product in the period of globalization, is its hybridization. And that hybridization, that mixing, as it were, through processes of selective emulation, of adaptation, of differentiation from Christian, as it were, and Japanese religious competition, as well as from differentiation from other Muslim religious competition, what we're seeing is an increasingly hybridized Islam. And much of the signs, much of, as it were, the most obvious signs of that hybridization is in the, as it were, the concrete, communicative, mechanical, indeed, architectural and organizational forms of Islam, that effectively Islam from the social base, as it were, of its organization and deployment looks much more like the Christian missionary organization of the 19th and 20th century than it does look like the forms of Muslim globalization through the Sufi brotherhoods in the early modern period and the medieval period. But also what I'm interested in the book too is not only, as it were, this external, let's say, mechanical and organizational forms of hybridization, but also I'm interested in semantic, the semantics of exchange, and let's say semantic hybridization as well. And I do try to trace in the book examples of ways in which, as it were, Muslim forms of expression, communication, language use, and indeed even the adoption of loan words, mishan, of course, a key one, but of course also kind of calque words as well, such as dawah, using, that's to say, kind of Arabic words to translate European words. I'm interested in showing then how this creates, as it were, forms of semantic hybridization as well. And of course, you know, the point is here that to try to work against an idea of Islamic exceptionalism, or indeed any other form of exceptionalism, that to try to trace, as a social historian, as a social scientist, try to trace underlying processes of globalization that are as applicable to Muslim religious firms and forms as they are to Christian, Japanese, Hindu, or any other religious or indeed cultural form under conditions of globalization.
Well, now, this is a fascinating book, and thank you for your time. We'd love to hear a little bit about the things you're working on now.
I'm just finishing off one of my other interests over many years, really, has been trying to build Afghan studies and try to promote the study of the history of Afghanistan. And I'm just finishing off an edited volume on what would seem to be the very obvious subject of the history of Islam in Afghanistan. And yet there is, despite a topic that, you know, one would have thought there must be endless shelves of books on this topic, there is no actual, as it were, kind of sequential history of the emergence and the development of Islam in Afghanistan over a period of, you know, its full length, 1,300 years. So that's an edited volume that will be coming out in December with the University of California Press. And I'm happy to say that that's going to be through their open access platform. So I'm not plugging a book I'm selling. I'm plugging a book that I'm giving away. And it's a collaborative book that I think is really going to be very useful in terms of showing, as it were, the long history of the development of Islam in Afghanistan from initial conversion through to the period of the recent jihad and the Taliban. And really, again, looking at ethnographic data and primarily trying to actually look at, as it were, the textual record of Afghan Muslims themselves over that long period. So that's been one of my projects. And another project I'm working on is another edited book, probably come out in a year or so, I guess, which is called The Frontiers of Persian Learning, Testing the Limits of a Eurasian Lingua Franca. And what I'm interested in doing here is, again, as a social scientist and a critical scholar, and I believe kind of critical study is really important. I think as academics, we're not meant to be boosters. We're meant to be analysts. And I'm interested in here in trying to move away from what I think has been a kind of celebratory phase of celebrating the Persian world as it were, cosmopolitan, as pluralistic, et cetera, et cetera. I'm actually trying to look at a series of the different frontiers and indeed fracture points of the Persian world by looking at social, geographical, and intellectual frontiers or fracture points, points at which Persian, as it were, its social reach, its intellectual reach breaks down for various reasons in various different places. And that's a book that is going to cover the full, as it were, remit globally of Persian in the period from around 1600 to 1900, right from, as it were, the Malay world of Southeast Asia, across South Asia, into Central Asia, and of course into Iran, but also taking on the British Empire and indeed looking at Persian usage in Imperial Britain in the 19th century as well.
Well, good luck with all that, and thanks again for spending some time talking about this book.
Okay, well, thank you, Krishna, and thanks to all of those listeners who've had the patience and endurance to make it this far.
That was my conversation with Niall Green about his great new book, Terrains of Exchange, Religious Economies of Global Islam, published with Oxford University Press in 2016. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.